the closer you are to the original immigrant, the more the issues are prevalent in your family. And the further away you are, the more you're punished sometimes by your own family for not having those issues important to you, which was really fascinating. This whole conversation and workshop started a few years ago when Ruby sat me down and just said that she needed a favor from me, which was to write a book, which I've never again asked her, how can I help? Anyway, the whole premise was trying to identify that which is cultural that is separate and apart from the mainframe of what is AHA process, which is economic diversity. So in the study of the culture and the study of the Hispanic culture, there has been this desire on my part to separate that which is economic and that which is cultural. And in truth, there's going to be a whole bunch of overlapping issues. And I'll go more into that in just a minute. Right now, the concern for the Hispanic culture is that, second only to American Indian, it has the highest dropout rate. In the United States, the graduation rate for Anglos is about 30% for the college graduation rate, not high school. For African Americans, it's about 18%. For Asian Americans, it's about 49%, but for Hispanic, it's really only about 12%. So we're falling really far behind in the college graduation rate nationwide. And among that, boys are even more at risk than girls are. As far as the concern that we have for what's going on in our schools, there seems to be a great divide in the understanding and the acceptance of the school culture. And again, the closer you are to the actual immigrant family, you know, immigrant and first generation, the more problematic culturally that's going to happen. Right now, there were some studies done with the prison cradle to prison pipeline. And one of the concerning things that I found was something they had in their writings was that a Latino boy born in 2001 has a 1 in 6 lifetime risk of going to prison, while a white boy born in 2001 has a 1 in 17 lifetime risk of going to prison. And for girls, the numbers are just vastly different, but for a Latina girl born in 2001, she has a 1 in 45 lifetime risk of going to prison, while a white girl born in 2001 has a 111 lifetime risk of going to prison. And before I go on any further with this, because this is a cultural conversation, I don't want to ever give the impression that I am mostly concerned about brown kids and while all the other ones, you know, play secondary. My main concern when I first started this workshop was to let everybody know that I love all kids, but I can't speak for all cultures as far as, you know, a visceral understanding. This is just the culture that I grew up in, and I understand it very well. But I work with all kids in our district, everyone has their own beauty of their own culture and their own rights. And so I don't want to – I should have said that at the beginning, but I just want to, you know, state that right now. Some of the things that you can be doing in school right now is – what the research shows is that if you target the oldest sibling – in the family, you'll probably get more bang for your buck when it comes to reaching out to the rest of the family. If the oldest sibling graduates from high school and furthermore graduates from college, it shows that there is much more impact and effect, and no greater impact and effect than the oldest sibling graduating in order to affect the younger siblings. However, when younger siblings graduate from high school or college, it doesn't seem to have much an effect on older siblings. So one of the things that some schools are doing is in the process of registering kids, they find out who's in the family and the birth order. And the oldest sibling is the person that you focus in on the strongest and the hardest, because there's nobody in the family that's setting the pattern for the family. I was working with a kid in high school who was going to be the first in his family to graduate high school and the first one to go to college. And while I was working with this child, we set up a mock college schedule with a college catalog in front of us. He went home. He was very excited. He told his father, "Guess what? I'm going to be taking 12 hours of college classes, and my schedule will look something like this." Well, because of the language and the tech language differences with what the father is accustomed to, what the boy is accustomed to, when the father heard him say, you're going to take 12 hours? That's for lazy people. You need to take at least 20. Well, when he came back to school the next day and he was kind of deflated, you know, and he said, my father said I need to take 20 hours and not 12 because 12 is for lazy people, I immediately understood that he was thinking about a job situation, that 20 hours is a part-time job. And so I had to explain to him that even though we both use the same word, which is hours, we don't mean the same thing. And that, you know, 20 hours in college is really a suicide track. You need really to take it your time. And that 12 hours is a full load. So I had to call the father as well and explain that. Now, again, the closer you get to the immigrant family, the less concerned, usually, especially if they come from poverty, the less concerned you're going to have, you're going to see in the family about a future story. What am I going to do 20 years down the line? What am I going to do 15 years down the line? It's usually the immediacy of today. So part of what the research shows, and this is very repetitive of what happens in the poverty, in the framework for poverty workshops, is that when kids do not have a future story, by third grade, which means if they cannot tell you what they want to be when they grow up by third grade, a Planned Parenthood did this research and a whole bunch of other companies did the exact same thing, and they came up with the same results. If by third grade a kid cannot tell you what he wants to be when he grows up, they have their chances of getting pregnant by the age of 15 rises 80%. So usually elementary schools really have a really, you know, big strong cross to bear when it comes to trying to get the kids to understand and think about the future. In a minute I'll tell you some of the gender differences of why that is and why that's more crucial in the Hispanic culture or anybody coming from a third world country. Right now there are certain things that elementary schools can be doing. For example, one of the things that our school is doing that I really like is every morning, the students say the Pledge of Allegiance. When they introduce themselves, one of the things they say is, my name is such and such. I plan on going to this college, and I want to major in this career. And so the kids are hearing every single day in the background what somebody's future plans are. And it kind of catapults different kind of conversations in the classroom as well. And I've also heard kids basically talk about this at lunch as well. So it's really been doing something. It's really important that kids also see themselves as being the kind of people that can graduate. Let me talk a little bit about stereotyping. You know, one of the things that is a caveat when it comes to diversity training or sensitivity training or anything that talks about multicultures is that a lot of people get very tentative in talking about things. And when I give workshops, when I discuss this one part, I get a lot of people who are nodding their heads and they're understanding. And I usually ask the question, how many of you have been to a workshop where it was about diversity training or sensitivity training where you walked away really offended by what was said because, you know, stereotypes were being spoken of and that's not how you understand it or the stereotypes seemed too rigid and it was very difficult to, you know, be okay with the information. Well, the thing is that when you talk about any kind of group, it's hard not to talk about generalizations. There is no way to not speak in stereotypes. And what I tell audiences normally is, you know, the thing is that stereotyping in and of itself is not a negative thing. It's not a positive thing. It's just a natural action that happens in our heads. And that we work on stereotypes. We always work on stereotypes because stereotyping by another word is called patterning. And your more advanced students that are in your AB courses in middle school and high school, your advanced courses, your gifted and talented programs, these are the kids that pattern faster than anybody else. These are the kids that can identify patterns and use them in literature and math, and they pick up. So it's really the same part of the brain that patterns is the exact same part of the brain that stereotypes. And the example I normally give is birth order. When we are in a room of 100 people and we point out the oldest sibling, we normally set, you know, we normally think, you know, well, what is the pattern for the oldest sibling? Well, they're bossy. They tend to know everything. They're in charge, you know. And for the youngest, they're the baby of the family. They're more spoiled. For the middle child, you know, they're the ones who, for those of you who know the Brady Bunch, it's the Marsha, Marsha, Marsha thing from Jan. It's just that constant, you know, pay attention to me. And then there's a pattern for the only children. And the only children, you know, their stereotype many times is that they're more mature than the other kids because their playmates are oftentimes adults. They don't play with a lot of kids. For example, if we also went to a gifted and talented workshop, we're going to talk in stereotypes about what a gifted and talented student's characteristics are. So we take those kind of stereotypes and we apply them in the broad base of things, but we never, ever, you know, rigidly say all children who are of this nature, this background, this color, this group, you know, act just like this. You know, what we need to do is we look at a kid, we understand the stereotype they're in, the pattern they're in, but then we have a responsibility to get to know them as individuals to see what makes them unique, you know, for or against those stereotypes. You know, we all are in a stereotype, every single one of us. If you're an educator, you're in a stereotype. But, you know, how are we different from the stereotype itself? So discussing stereotypes is okay as long as you don't think or treat people as if that stereotype is an absolute terminal definition. Okay, moving on. One of the things that a lot of people lose sight of over is that there are 24 different countries where Spanish is the main language, and that's where Hispanic people come from. Now, when we look at those, 20 of those countries are third world countries. Three of those countries are kind of like second world. And those are that's terminology more for political standings. I know it's not an economic friendly, but I haven't found a term that everybody understands immediately. So when I say second world and third world, I'm speaking economically, even though those terms are more political. But that gets people understanding what I'm talking about as far as the economic base. When you have a group of people, Hispanics or Latinos, that come from predominantly third world countries, what you're going to have is a real big mishap or a misunderstanding as to what life is like, or because people are not going to be talking about life the same way. That's not to say that everybody in Spanish-speaking countries come from poverty. While by and large the population is absolutely in poverty in many of those countries, not everybody is. And here's where is an example that I'm talking about going against the stereotypes. We had a student who was from, where was he from? I forgot the country. I'll remind myself in a minute. He was from a country, he came from a family of great wealth. He lived in what we would say a palace over here. And there was a teacher who did mission work in the country that he came from. So she was asking him about his home. She says, I've been to your country. It's just, it's beautiful, but, you know, I want to know about, you know, where you come from and what you did. So she was trying to build a relationship. She was going about it, but everything he said about his life, she really didn't believe. She didn't heed his message. So for 3 days, as she's trying to get information out of him, she finally looked at him and said, I just want to know, in your home, did you have dirt floors? Well, I was called about a week or two after that conversation was had because he had shut down completely. And when he finally opened up to me, what he said was, you know, here I was, I've moved here because my aunt has insisted. You know, I was telling this teacher about my life because she seemed really interested in me. And all of a sudden, she asked me if I had dirt floors. And she goes, she didn't believe a word I said. I come from a very rich family. I just don't tell people about it. It's nobody's business. Again, applying a stereotype to any one person is really the more the egregious nature than when you look at a broad-based group. The other thing is that if you look at a map or globe, what you're going to find is these countries that are predominantly third world are the ones that are the closest to the equator in comparison to the United States. And in the workshop I give, what I show is a map of literacy around the United States. And so the darker the country looks, the more literate the people are, the higher percentage of people that are literate. The lighter the color of the country, the less literate the people in that country are. Well, what you find is that the closer to the equator you are, the less literate people are. And part of that reasoning is that the closer to the equator you are, the longer your growing season. The longer your growing season, the more agrarian your country becomes or your lifestyle. Well, what I call it, just to put it simply, is that the further from the equator you are, where it's much colder and warmer for a less period of time, what you develop is an indoor culture. The closer to the equator you are and the more time you can spend outside, the more of an outdoor culture you obtain. So in all honesty, when you get closer to the equator, that's where you're going to find more bartering, more trading, you're going to find less use of money and more use of people and their talents and labors for exchange of goods and services. So that is part of just how the culture is set, because geography very many times does have something to do with creating the practices of a culture. Now, let's talk a little bit about why people actually immigrate over here. When I was writing this workshop about 5 years ago, when I created this one section about, you know, why people actually immigrate to this country, that's when the immigration conversation in politics was becoming very intense. And I also did not want to say anything that would imply pity or imply, you know, people wanting to rescue people. I just wanted to give more factual information that was not based on any kind of judgment or emotions or whatever. It was just, you know, these are the whys. So what I started doing was comparing children in the United States who run away from home, who have the security of home, to people who run away from their country, basically, and come to the United States. So I called the information hotline for runaways, and what I found out is that about a little over 14% of children between the ages of 10 and 17 are declared as runaways at some point in time. Now, I have no statistics or understanding if that runaway was gone for 10 minutes or 24 hours or any length of time, but not all runaways are reported, so I thought that was a conservative number anyway. So 14% of those children are declared as runaways. And when we stop and think about what condition must be present for someone to be willing to leave the security of home and leave home and run away from home, you know, it kind of paralleled why people leave. And usually it has to do with the feeling of safety, the feeling of the lack of freedom. There's just, you know, dismay going on. There's some sort of conflict going on where people are able to leave. Now, obviously, you can't compare the magnitude of someone leaving their country or their family to someone leaving their home here, but it's still that kind of heart-wrenching feeling where you feel there is better beyond this, and I've got to go in search of it, and I'm willing to take risks of what that is. So we get into those kind of conversations there. So the four main reasons for immigration is poverty, lack of democracy, education, and asylum. So those are poverty, obviously. There's not a lot of good job bases for people to make income. You know, here in the United States, if someone was working minimum wage, you know, one of the questions we ask is how long would it take for someone in a minimum wage job, how long would it take someone to work to get out of poverty? Well, the answer is they would never get out of poverty staying at minimum wage. Well, for what the wages are in a lot of these countries, they remain in poverty, and many times it's worse poverty than the poverty we experience here in the United States. So that's why, you know, people come. When people move to a new country, many times very simple practices are very confusing. There's just what would seem to be obvious to a lot of people about us, and the one way I put it for others is, you know, when you look at people from the United States that leave this country to go work somewhere else, whether abroad or within this continent, when people leave, there's a big difference between people who leave a first world country, or they call this a developed country, a power country, when they leave from a first world country and they go work or visit a third world country. Now reverse that. If someone from a third world country was come to visit the United States, if you compare someone, a United States person going to another country, a third world, versus the opposite, well, somebody from a first world country is going to be in a much better position to maneuver, you know, economics, to understand what to look for if they're going to purchase something or open a business, or they're just visiting and getting a hotel. When someone from a third world country who definitely is in poverty comes to the United States, they're at a disadvantage. They really don't understand how to do certain things, and many times there is a strong feeling of unworthiness. So they're dependent very much so on the graciousness of other people, or there's just this fear that they're not going to get much accomplished, but they're going to do the best they can, and they're going to do everything. And there's kind of, there's many times a very naive approach to things. When people move over here, one of the biggest issues, and this can be a great conversation base in your high schools or your middle schools particularly, is that there is an erasing of your history with the terms Latino or Hispanic. Now, if you'll notice the title of this workshop, it is basically understanding the Latino slash Hispanic culture. And the reason I have both names there is because there is no agreement as to which one is more proper than the other. You know, different parts of the United States, like New York is going to, most New Yorkers are going to use the word Latino, while here in Texas, we're going to use Hispanic. And some people argue about which is right. You know, I'm not Hispanic, I'm Latino, and vice versa. And then there's Chicano. You know, Chicano is more prevalently used in California. And that seems, you know, the only thing that I can say about Chicano is that it seems to be more involved with people who are more politically minded or much more of an advocate. You know, they're just more boisterous. But again, there is no agreement on all this. So the one thing that some people, when they're speaking in front of a group, can sometimes get in trouble over is saying Hispanic if the majority of the people there say Latino. So what I just tell people is that normally what you do is acknowledge what is predominantly used where you're going, wherever you're speaking or wherever you live. If that's what people use, that's what you use. And you just nod your head and say, okay. Because if you read all the literature on this, there's, you know, dozens of reasons why people suspect where Latino came from and where Hispanic came from. But there is no agreement between all the experts. So it really becomes a very secondary issue, except when people start arguing it. You know, and there's a whole bunch of other labels and names that people have used. So that's something that you can address very simply at the thing. But let me tell you how that erases culture. If somebody is from Puerto Rico or, let's say, Cuba, you know, or Colombia, if they're from any one of those countries and they go to, let's say, well, like here, Texas. Here in Texas, the majority of Hispanics have Mexican origin. They are, their family or they themselves are from Mexico. So, if, for example, they'll go to a parent night meeting and they'll say it's Hispanic night or this is multicultural night and there's Hispanic food in this section of the cafeteria. Well, if all the Hispanic food is actually its origins from Mexico, then the Puerto Ricans and the Cubanos and the Ecuadorians will all go, that's not my food. That may be Hispanic, but it's not from my country. And so there's this kind of misnomer going on that sometimes can be a little offensive because I was at a meeting with some adults, and these were political leaders, you know, where after an hour and a half into this committee meeting, there was one lady who shall remain nameless, but she was a very strong political leader. And all of a sudden, she pounded her hand on the table and said, I want to know what we're going to call this committee before we go on further, because if we call it Hispanic, everybody's going to always think that I'm Mexican, and I'm not. I'm Puerto Ricana. And all of a sudden, there's this huge outburst of arguing and yelling and screaming among everybody, because everybody who was not a Mexican understood. And they were all very frustrated over being having their culture erased from them. So that was kind of fascinating. So those kind of conversations in school need to happen with no judgment, just kind of acknowledgement as to this is kind of important to individuals, but on the big and large part of it, it really doesn't ever, it's not going to get solved. We're going to stick with one name, and that'll be okay. Now, other things that are not known about, and this is some things that can be take care of during registration day, is like laws about attendance. A lot of times, you know, you will, you'll get is a lot of Hispanics who will say, my child was absent because I was sick and he was taking care of me. And they'll think that was an excused absence because of my, I'm the parent and I know what he was doing and I approved of it. Therefore, it should be excused. And it's not. It, you know, in many school districts, it's not an excused absence. It's very much unexcused, and no matter if you give a note or not. But it's something that needs to happen. And there's also great fear for those people who are not documented that schools are linked with immigration. And so when people do not know that schools have no connection with the immigration offices, what you often get is parents who tell their kids to keep a low profile, don't say anything, keep quiet. And it isn't long before some of them start to act out, because it's almost like they don't know where to draw the line. You know, when you say don't draw attention to the family, well, it's sometimes don't draw attention ever. Don't ever be yourself. Don't ever act, you know, normal. And some kids don't know where to draw that line, so it becomes a very frustrating reality. So many times the kids themselves need to know that it is okay to be who they are and okay to be themselves, and they need many times an outlet just to let their hair down and talk. But that still is very intimidating for the parents. There's some very many true stories that have come across this desk where there's been kids who were on the honor roll, and suddenly their name was posted somewhere, or their name was announced over the intercom, or there was some big hoopla or the newsletter, you know, here's our honor roll A and B students, and the kids have been told specifically not to draw attention to themselves. And then suddenly when they see their name posted somewhere or announced over the intercom, they freak out. They just totally get so nervous they never get on the honor roll again because they don't know how to handle that situation. So many times we need to talk to parents and say, we're so proud of your child. Do we have your permission to post their name? Can we say their name over the intercom? So that's just part of what's going on there. You know, and the other thing is because, like I said, 20 countries are from, 20 of them are third world countries. Within a third world country, what you often do not have is a middle class. The middle class, you either have those, the rich and the poor, but the middle section really does not exist. So middle class norms and values are really kind of a missing link in comparing those countries to ours. So there is no parallel for them to get, no way of living styles for bilingual education versus regular education is another concern. I was shocked a few years ago. I was teaching adults English in an English learning school, and there was something said in the corner of the room, and what I heard somebody say, I couldn't believe what I heard. And so I asked them to repeat it, and what the guy said to me was, you know, we tell everybody here at the school to tell their we tell them, do not allow your children to ever be in one of those bilingual classes. You say no. And I said, why? And he said, because schools get extra money. What he meant was stipends. Schools get extra money for children who are in bilingual classes and special ed classes, and schools never want them to get out of those classes, so they don't teach them English and they don't make them learn. Because if they get out of the bilingual classes, then the schools don't get any more extra money. And so I had to tell them my stuff, but I could tell that there was this look of skepticism with them. And I had to explain, you know, you have to get, you know, have more faith in your school. But then again, I came from that kind of school. So if that's really happening within certain schools, I really don't know because I don't work at 3 million schools. But that belief was in the neighborhood and had been there for quite some time, and we never knew about it. And had I not started talking to the adults, I would never have known that that was a problem. You know, and the other thing is homeowners associations, you know, neighborhood associations. You know, there's just, in a lot of countries, what you do with your yard and your home is your business. The color you paint it, what you have in your front yard, like cars or anything like that, nobody's going to tell you what you can and cannot have in your yard because that belongs to you. And so those kind of belief systems also transfer over here. So many times you get a sponsor family. You get people who are willing to mentor or sponsor, not financially but with time, an immigrant family, a first-generation American family, to say these are the things you need to know to be strong and, you know, here and stuff like that. When people come from a different country, they're going to bring their customs and their traditions with them. Now, here's a parallel story, and it's true. When I was vacationing in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, about 3 or 4 years ago, I was with friends of mine who are from Mexico. We walked into a market across from the hotel we were staying, and my friend Felipe looked over at this jack-o'-lantern. It was a clay jack-o'-lantern, and he just pointed at it and got very angry. And I was like, "What do you mean? What's wrong?" And he said, "Your people did this to us." And I had no clue what he was talking about. And I said, "My people? My people? Who people? Who my people?" And he goes, "Your American people did this to us." And so I just started the jack-o'-lantern. I said, "We brought the jack-o'-lantern? What?" He goes, "The jack-o'-lantern is not a Mexican tradition. It is American." And so basically, let me summarize the story for you. What happened was, in San Miguel de Allende, they have beautiful and wonderful traditions that center around Day of the Dead. And one of the traditions is that they put candles on boats and they have masses and they do all these services for the Day of the Dead, which is November 1st for adults and November 1st for children, November 2nd for adults, I don't remember, one vice versa. But anyway, there's a small section in San Miguel where there are Americans who have retired. They've purchased property over there, and I'm not quite sure how because I know that's illegal, but they've purchased property over there. They live over there, and the retirement community has grown. And every October, what the retirees do is they put jack-o'-lanterns with candles in their windows. Well, that's something that made them feel at home, but the natives did not understand. Well, as the population for the retirement community grew, the grandchildren started to visit. Well, on October 31st, you can only imagine what happened. The kids started trick-or-treating. So as the kids started trick-or-treating more often as the years went on, then the neighborhood kids started looking at them and saying, "You know what? We need a bag, we need a mask, and we get free candy." So they were very excited about that. So what started happening now as the years have gone on, the trick-or-treating or the Halloween customs have kind of blended with the Day of the Dead customs, so they come together. And my friend who's a purist said, the way he said it in Spanish was, the Americans have fornicated on the sanctity of our traditions. Well, there's a lot of Americans who feel the exact same way about the traditions we have here and when people come from another country. So all that to say, people don't, you know, the Americans were not trying to take over Mexico via the jack-o'-lantern. They were just doing what made them feel at home and comfortable in a foreign country. Well, everybody does that. But the thing is that people also need to know the differences as to, you know, where maybe certain parameters are drawn or what's appropriate or how to express those things. One of the customs that the kids do here that really bugs a lot of teachers that I'm really shocked about, it just kind of surprised me because it was not on my radar more than anything else, is that kids will address teachers by saying miss or teacher. You know, they'll say miss, you know, or teacher, I need help. Well, a lot of teachers, educators, get really offended when the kids don't use their name. When they say, my name is Miss, you know, Smith, you know, call me by my name. Well, and this was a fascinating reality for me. The use of miss or teacher is actually a direct translation from Spanish, and it is the epitome of respect. When a kid addresses a teacher in Spanish from one of those countries, they say profesor, profesora, which is professor or masculine or feminine, or señora or señor, which is miss or mister. Well, you translate that to Spanish, and it directly is miss or teacher. Well, when the kids don't use their names, and this is a very long this is a very short way of explaining a very long explanation, but the Spanish language has many roots and has a strong base in being a servitude. So it responding that way without saying somebody's name, there's kind of this practice where if you are politically or somewhere beneath someone in the pecking order, you are not worthy or allowed to say someone's name. And it's very difficult for a kid, many kids, for them to learn to start saying someone's names because it feels disrespectful. It feels very wrong. And the only way I can explain it the best is this. I have two students I taught in elementary school. When I started working with the high schools, I continued to stay friends with the family. And the family kind of adopted me as this uncle figure with the girls. So I started hanging out with the family a lot more. Well, after one of the girls went to college and the other one was still in high school, I looked at the girls one day and I said, you know what? I was your music teacher a long time ago. I am now just a friend of the family. You can start calling me Ruben. You're much older. You don't have to call me Mr. Perez. And the girls took 4 years to break out of that comfort. They said, we can't call you Mr. Perez. That's gross. It was very difficult for them to call me by a name that was much more familiar. And that's what a lot of kids go through. So many times you have to have those kind of conversations with your kids and say, you know, it may be very respectful where you come from to say miss or teacher, you know, or señor or profesor, but it's not appropriate here. It's offensive. And you will find that a lot of kids are very shocked over that. Now, gender roles is another thing that really takes on a significant difference between the countries. As a matter of fact, in the video that I have with the company AHA Process, it's called Welcome to U.S. Schools. I address with the parents that there is a huge difference in the country that they come from and the United States as far as gender roles. And one of the things that I stress a lot is that women are much more equal over here and they share responsibilities with men more than in a lot of other foreign countries. That women that need to be, that girls when they go to school are going to find that many times their tendency to be soft-spoken and hide in the background is going to work against them. That girls need to find their voice. They need to actually exercise their voice. And that when they come home and the parents have discovered that the girls have a voice, that it's hard to not think that this is disrespectful, but it actually is a difference in understanding of the two different countries. So that's part of the video that explains that. We've got a few more minutes before we go to the Q&A section, so I'm just going to fast forward to some of the classroom applications, things that you can do. So that was basically, in a nutshell, some of the cultural stuff. You know, one of the things that I really stress on, you have some speech problems, and the kids who cannot find their voice don't speak. You really want to get kids to speak out more in classroom. So one of the things I suggest is one of the things that are tenets of the workshop is that after you teach about 10 minutes, you stop talking and you tell the kids, now repeat what I just said to your neighbor or explain what I just said to your neighbor, where you give them a chance to speak so they can literally and figuratively find their voice. That's really important. You're going to avoid cold readings. Many kids who have accents, you will find, are kind of embarrassed by their own accents. Some don't have any problem with it whatsoever, but many kids do. So you want to avoid cold readings because on top of the reading cold, you know, fear, you know, it's also communication. So many times what I did is I gave kids, either assigned them homework, and I said, you're going to read this tonight because you're going to read part of it in front of everybody, or we read it quietly. Now, here's what the teacher has to do, and I just through experience, you know, really can confirm this. While the kids are practicing what they're going to read, they're reading what they're going to read, pre-reading, the worst thing a teacher can do is sit at their desk and just allow them to read, because kids who don't feel confident with the language are not going to ask you, what is this word, or what does this word mean? While kids are sitting down, practicing their reading, reading out loud, et cetera, you have to be roaming the room. Because it really wasn't, and I've done this from elementary through high school, it isn't until you're near the kid and have close proximity that kids actually stop and say, what is this word and what does this mean? if you have kids that are immigrants or first generation and are really struggling with the language, one of the things that I discovered is that the rhythm and the cadence of the English language is actually an inhibitor. It really is so foreign to the way people speak Spanish, because Spanish has a different rhythm and cadence, and there's a sing-song to it. That sing-song really does not exist in English. And so one thing that I found really worked well is that I showed a scene from a movie. I think one year I showed a clip of The Little Mermaid where Sebastian the crab and he was talking to somebody else, and I just put it on, and he was talking to the little fish, I forgot his name. But I showed about 10 or 15 minutes of a clip. I found the script to that movie on the internet. So I showed the script, and then I split everybody into groups, and I had them act out or read out what they just saw on the film. And what I discovered was, one, they were reading above their typical reading level, because the script is higher than a fifth grade level. But they were also adding the vocal animation to it. So they were, what I started noticing was their rhythm and cadence started mimicking the English language, and they also had a better delivery. So it was much better than they had it been just a book. So many times being able to mimic someone or being able to mimic somebody else really helps, because it's been modeled for them. So that modeling of how to say these words, how to deliver them, how to execute them, it's kind of theater techniques. So it is 6:15 now, and I'm just going to stop to see if there's any questions before we continue.
I have three questions.
Okay.
The first is, you mentioned building a relationship and a collegiate future story with the oldest sibling as having a positive effect on the rest of the siblings in terms of behavior and aspirations. Do you find the same benefits if their future story is trade or vocational as opposed to collegiate?
Yes. I've been thinking about that. Is the question, does that work also with vocations?
I think they're acting, the way I understand it is, if you mentioned that the future story was collegiate, as in the oldest sibling was going to college, do you find that same benefit, that worked well for their younger siblings? Is that what you said? I think that's how I remember it.
Yes, absolutely. Because if the older siblings are also bullies and they're drug addicts or whatever, or involved in crime, that also affects the younger siblings as well. So it's kind of an all-blending thing. Whatever the older siblings are doing usually has a very strong correlation for the younger. Again, not always.
Okay. Second question. Do you have any suggestions on how to communicate effectively to a parent that the absences you discussed as them finding acceptable are in fact not?
What I found is, a lot of times when people say this kind of information, there's sometimes hesitation or judgment in somebody's voice. It has to be just non-judgmental, blank. Here's what is approved or not approved. I forgot the word terminology. Here's what we approve as an absence. Here's what we don't approve. And here's how many you can have, no matter if it's approved or not approved, before the court gets involved or a ticket is issued or a warning is issued. And you just say it very plainly, but not overly stern, because you're going to be, it is intimidating information. But you don't hesitate, because a lot of time hesitation can also be confused with judgment or mockery.
Okay, last question, and then if you have anything you'd like to wrap up with. I've never heard that using someone's name like that was disrespectful. Can you give me an idea of how widespread that is, or is it just a few certain countries?
Repeat the question, please.
I think it's referring to... You were saying miss or teacher was common.
Yes.
But it says, I've never heard that using someone's name like that was disrespectful. Can you give me an idea of how widespread that is, or is it just certain countries?
It is very widespread, but it is not all countries, and I cannot tell you which countries for sure it is not. I am more familiar with the countries where it is. I being Mexican, I was taught not to say – now, I was never told not to say words or somebody's name. It was modeled for me. And as I was being corrected, I was – as parents feed the words to their children, they say, you say yes sir, you say no sir, you say this, you say that. I was really never told to say a name. It just becomes part of the background or hidden rule. But it is very much a rule. Now, is it a rule, a hidden rule in every single Spanish-speaking country? No. And what you're going to find is the more educated that country is, the less of the rule that is. That's kind of a basic rule of thumb for you.
Okay. Those are all. Let me check real quick. I believe, and again, the email address, if you have any questions as we wrap up, is questions@ahaprocess.com. That's all I have right now. So if you have anything you'd like to finish up with, I'm sure we'd love to hear it.
I think more than anything else, and feel free to email the question as I'm talking. I think more than anything else that, again, cultural conversations just seems to clam everybody up. And there has to be a point where you're able to laugh at yourself, you know, for the, you know, and I'll give you for instance. This is a ridiculous situation, but it's honestly, absolutely, shamefully true. We all think in stereotypes the more we do not understand a group. The further we are from something and the more the only thing we know about them is from television or childhood stories, the more stereotype in nature we're going to present them. My very first Egyptian student, I had my very first Egyptian student walk into my classroom. She was straight from Egypt. And the girl was just beautiful, but I heard a week before that I was getting a student from Egypt. She was flying in, and she was going to be my student. And I was just so excited because I grew up with black and white mummy movies. Now, trust me, I know how ridiculous it's going to sound. But, you know, the picture in my head of an Egyptian person came from the 1950s mummy movies with Long Chaney. And so I would have expected the little girl to walk in with a headband and a cobra. And I can't tell you how ridiculous I felt when I thought those things. And she walked in, and admittedly I was, you know, a little disappointed. There was no headband and a cobra. But I don't know anything about Egypt other than those black and white films. And so if the only thing you know about Hispanic cultures really comes from movies, it's really going to be much more of a stereotype, you know. So you kind of have to challenge yourself to be much more broad-minded and not be so judgmental of yourself or others as well, and to just relax. You know, people are people, and human nature is human nature no matter where you come from. And we have much more in common than we don't. And everybody has a beautiful background, you know, and things that we need to learn from as well.
Well, great. Thank you, Ruben. And thank you all of you who took this time out of your day to be with us for the last hour. Again, Ruben is available to consult at your school, so if you're interested in that, please give our office a call. Or again, our website is www.ahaprocess.com. His DVD, again, is called Welcome to U.S. School, is also available there. And at this point, unless we don't have any more questions, so I think we'll go ahead and let everybody go. Thank you very much, Ruben.
Thank you. Bye, everybody. Have a good end of the year.
And you too. Bye, everyone.
Bye.